Tune in every Saturday evening from 6 to 7pm for a Life in Focus, where we will be chatting with a local personality about their life, work, leisure and philosophy. BCRFM, putting a life in focus every Saturday from 6 to 7. Good evening and you're very welcome along to Life in Focus. And this evening we have a very special guest in studio. It is Father Sean Lawler. Father Sean, you're very welcome to the show this evening.
Thank you very much.
You have now a very interesting story to tell. You beg to differ, I think, from discussing it with you a little bit beforehand. But maybe if you want to start off and just tell us a little bit about you yourself.
Okay, thank you very much, Ashley. My name is Sean Lawler. I am a priest from Limerick, born there, reared in Killarney, and reared a little bit further down the road in Cork City. Then my parents actually came back to Limerick again, but in the meantime I had gone away to school to the Redemptress in Limerick City, their college. I then eventually went to their novitiate, their house of studies, and I was ordained in 1964, and then immediately they sent me and six or seven colleagues who were ordained that year with me, sent us to Brazil. So we arrived in Brazil in August 1964. And we went by ship, would you believe it? There was no such thing as flights to South America in those days. To me, it only sounds like yesterday, but to a lot of the young people today, I'm sure I sound like a dinosaur, but however. We arrived in Brazil anyway, by ship. It took us 29 days on the sea to get to Brazil. Would you believe that?
29 days.
Well, we had a few stops. Yeah, we had a few stops. We had one in Madeiras because the captain had... he had some friend maybe in his past life in Madeira, so we stopped there. He didn't tell us.
A quick little holiday on the way.
Exactly, and then we went to the Barbados, and we went to Trinidad. But when we got to Barbados, we found the Trinidadian cargo was underneath the Barbadian cargo. It was a cargo ship, and they had to jump around from island to island. We eventually arrived there and were picked up by the Irish Redemptress. Now, I might say a word about, tell you about the Irish Redemptress. They went to Brazil in 1960. That was only 3 years, 4 years before I arrived in Brazil, but they had set up quite a mission in those 3 or 4 years. The boss there at the time was Father Jim McGrath. He would have been well known in Irish religious context. Jim has a charitable connection too. His sister, Mary Mullins, has a pharmacy here in town, in Charleville. And he also had a brother, Tim McGrath, who played rugby for Ireland. So the name McGrath is well known in this area. Jim was boss there when we went out and set us down to learn the language immediately. And Jim had me hearing confessions after 6 weeks. And what language I had after 6 weeks now, you could put it into an echo. I'm sure the people going to confession were thrilled because they knew that I didn't know.
All their sins.
Ashling, you could have gone yourself, you'd got away with it.
Got away with nearly murder, I'd
exactly.
Say.
So, what was our work in Brazil like? You might ask me. Well, work was generally parish work. But parish work in Brazil at the time was extremely different from what we would regard as parish work here, because there was a huge element of social work in it. And when I say social work now, there were, for instance, there were no doctors in the area I was in. There were no nurses, there was no hospital, there was no clinic. There was nothing in the health area and very, very little in the educational area. So one of the priests in Brazil was a fellow called Jim Collins. He later became a bishop in Brazil, and I went off with him, and we started a new diocese. And the new diocese was called Miracema do Norte, Miracema of the North.
I don't think I'll try and say that.
Yeah, Miracema do Norte. The next parish was even harder to pronounce. Parnaíba do Piauí was the next parish I would see.
It's good to know that you've got a handle on the Portuguese now, anyway.
Thank God I have. After many years, I had a good handle on Portuguese. And still work with the Brazilian Society here in Ireland. But I'll tell you about that in a moment, you know. Now, in this area, we went into a place, a little town called Miracema. Miracema was 600 miles exactly from the state capital. The state was called Goiás, and our town was 600 miles. It was more than twice the length of Ireland. and no road. Well, I say no road now. There was a road, a dirt track. And that took you, take me, two or three days to go to the state capital. And you'd be travelling 16, 17 hours a day, and it would take 3 days to do the state capital. And you could be sure, on a good day, you'd only get 4 or 5 punctures.
On a good
day. 5 punctures on a good day. And on a bad day...
I was going to say, do I dare ask you on a bad day?
On a bad day, well, you'd get so many, you'd stop and you'd have to buy new tyres and tubes. In those days, we used to use tubes too. But you'd have to buy tyres on the way down because of the rough road. And
would there be, like, even a place that you could?
There would be
a trucker stop. It doesn't sound like it was that built up, you know.
There would be a town about every 150 miles or so. A small town. There would be gas stations about every 60, 70 miles, and they would change tyres for you, and they would do that sort of stuff for you. And they would feed you and dine you and wine you and
whatever else
you wanted there. And most of these places would have, well, we would call them showers in those days, but they wouldn't be shower. You'd get a little private cubicle, and you'd have a bucket of water, and they'd give you a tin, like you've got bright prunes in or something like that, and that's how you washed yourself, with the tin and a bucket of water.
So how did it feel, though, to kind of come from Ireland and your kind of home comfort and just be pretty much landed into that kind of a situation?
We were like you are now, Aisling. We were young and you were on for anything. And the rougher it was, the better. And the more challenging it was. I remember one young fellow, Cullen. Harold Cullen was his name. He left. He's a priest in America, but he didn't ever go to Brazil. But he said to me when I was going out, he said, Sean, don't modernise the place, whatever you do, because I want to experience it the way it is.
So it's a rough and ready kind of...
I said, don't worry, Harold, I will never be able to modernise Brazil. And it's true.
However, but you did set up your diocese,
We set up a diocese, we set up hospitals, we brought in doctors, as I said, and set up clinics and nurses, and we set up a model farm. The government gave us a huge tract of land, thousands of acres, I would say, they gave us, to run a model farm. And GORTA, the Irish Agricultural Association, gave us thousands of... They used to give us, I think, about £80,000 a year they used to give us to run this model farm, which was huge money.
And may I ask, a model farm to me that...
A model farm to you means nothing,
actually. No.
A model farm meant that you were able to pay Irish engineers to come out and to teach the men and boys in the particular area how to farm, how to raise cattle, how to breed cattle, how to grow rice, how to grow beans, how to grow soya, how to do just about everything like that.
So it was just a training ground.
It was a training college, and it was huge, and there were fine buildings there. Actually, there was an old school there at one stage, but we took it over and made an agricultural college out of it. So it was an agricultural college, and it worked very well. And to this day, 50 years later, it's still going and still training young fellas how to farm their own bits of land. So that was one real success story, the model farm, sponsored by GORTA in Dublin in those early days. Now, some of the difficulties that we would have to... You wouldn't experience them in Ireland at all, you couldn't imagine. It was distance. The distances into the main city. The distances to any place. When you wanted, for instance, when we got electricity after a number of years, and you wanted a fridge for the kitchen, you had to go 1,000 miles to buy the fridge. Because it would only be in São Paulo or Rio de Janeiro or one of these places, and that was 1,000 miles ago. And there was only a hardtop road for half of that. So you had 500 to 600 miles on a dirt road.
With all your punctures and
now
your fridge on top as well.
Exactly.
What kind of vehicles did you have then? Were they like...
Jeeps.
Okay,
They were Willys Jeeps, and they were made by Ford, I understand, in those days. And they were Brazilian. They were made in Brazil. Now, you'd say, well, how would such a primitive country make cars? São Paulo was the industrial centre of the world, I'd say, at that stage, or one of the centres of the world, like Chicago and Detroit and that. And there were more factories in São Paulo when I went there in 1916. You could possibly imagine. There were 30,000 factories in São Paulo alone.
Wow.
I would say today, I have no idea, I'm going to make up a number, I'd say there's probably 130,000 factories. And they make... All the cars, like the Jeeps and that, Volkswagens are made in Brazil. The Volkswagen Beetle was made in Brazil. In fact, about 3 years ago, they made their millionth Volkswagen in Brazil. And they suspended them after making a million. And were so popular, demand was so great in Asia and in Argentina and Chile, they went back making Volkswagens again. And they're still making them there. But you have Chevrolet, and you have Toyota, and you have Volkswagen. You have just all those big industries going in São Paulo.
So back at the time again, though, you were able to travel in relative comfort then, I guess.
Yeah, we had Jeeps. Relative would be the word there, relative comfort, because you just bounced along in a Jeep.
Because of the potholes.
You did, yeah.
Although, that could be said for the roads in Ireland today as well.
It could, but we used to always think in Brazil, oh my God, if we were only at home, this car would last forever. And it only used to last 2 or 3 years in Brazil, you see, It'd be just so bad. Yeah, the roads were so bad. Then eventually we graduated to Volkswagen Beetles. I had a couple of Volkswagen Beetles, and they were nearly as good as the Jeep. You couldn't carry too much in them, but you could carry yourself and a few suitcases or whatever. But they were good, and they gave us great service, the Jeeps there. The domestic problems in Brazil were difficult because we had no electricity.
Yeah, we had no electricity.
I was a secretary to an Irishman who became a bishop there, a fellow called Jim Collins from Moyvan, County Kerry, and he was a dynamo, an absolute dynamo. He set up that model farm and the hospitals and everything else. He was just a wonderful man. That area owes a huge amount to Jim Collins.
And do you know much about the setting up of it? Like, how did that come about?
Yeah.
You know,
I do. I was there with him setting it up, the whole thing. Yeah,
the whole thing from start.
Hospitals and that you set up through the government. You get in league with the government, and they finance it, and you get the doctors, and you get the people from Canada and people from anywhere, technicians from Ireland here we had, and set it up and let them run it, and they did, and it's still running. The hospital we set up in that little town, where there was never anything. There was a pharmacist. Mary Mullen would be glad to hear this. There was a pharmacist, a fellow called Euripides. And Euripides wasn't a pharmacist, but he called himself a pharmacist. And he was a wonder worker. He was a wonder worker. He did everything. When anyone was sick, he did it. He cured them, myself included, and the bishop. He cured everyone. In fact, one time I told him my little doggy, I had a beautiful little dog, and the dog was giving birth, and she was having great difficulties. He said, I'll go up. He came up and he did this. This is the man now who wasn't a pharmacist. He came up and he did a cesarean section on her, and she was perfect.
She's grand.
Yeah, she was perfect. She had 6 pups, and she was perfect.
All because of him.
I went back to see him last year in Brazil, last Christmas, when you were in the middle of the snow, I was in the middle of 90 degrees heat.
I went back
to see my old pal Euripides, but he was dead. He had been buried.
Oh, no.
So I was very sad. But I met his wife, and I met some of his children. Well, I only met one girl. Sorry, I met one girl. His boy also had died, and another girl had died. But the one girl was alive. I met her. It was lovely to meet them again and tell her stories that she didn't even know about her father, which was lovely to be able to tell her.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so there you go. That was the domestic problem, you see. We had a very poor house. In fact, we had no house when I went there first. There was an old garage, and I slept in the old garage.
Can you kind of describe for me what that... Because an old thing, to me, is it a shack, or was it built well? I would have no idea.
The garage was about the size of an ordinary sitting room or dining room in an Irish home. That's what it was. And that's where there were cattle in it before we came. And then there was an old priest there before he used to park his old Jeep there. And when we went then, he moved, himself and his mother moved to her house, and we lived in the garage.
So this was 1964 when you went out, you lived in this. And the Redemptorists had been on the ground for, say, the 4 years previous.
They had, but they had not been in the ground in this place where Jim Collins and I set up a new diocese. They were now 1,500 miles from us.
Oh, okay.
And we left them in the sense to set up a new diocese. because the church, I say the church now, I don't know who asked us. I presume Rome asked us, or the bishops in Brazil asked us to set up a new diocese. So we took a bit of an old diocese called Porto Nacional, and we called the new one Mira Sema do Norte, because that was the town, and the diocese was bigger than Ireland. And when we went into that diocese, bigger than Ireland, we found 3 priests there, 3 Brazilian priests there. And 2 of us went in with a lay brother. There were 3 of us, so now there were 6 in the diocese, the size of Ireland. So it used to take the bishop and myself, it would take us more or less 9 months or so to go around to visit every nook and cranny in the diocese.
Wow.
Driving, yes.
I think it's hard to kind of imagine how big the place actually was.
It is. It is. Brazil actually is 100 times bigger than Ireland. It's 32 million square miles, and Ireland is 32,000 square miles. It's 32 million square miles. And that is bad enough. But when you consider that there are very few roads, relatively speaking, to the size of the country, then it gets worse and worse.
And was the kind of population really sparse around the area then,
yes,
as well?
Yes. In that diocese that we went into, there was less than 200,000 people. Less than 200,000 people when we went there. I don't know. I have no idea today how many. I'd say it is booming. I'd say there would be millions in that diocese today.
And what do the people originally that were there kind of think of these people coming on in, kind of, you know, saying this is how it's going to be from now on?
Well,
kind of?
You see, we didn't go in and say that, really. We went in and tried to help them at what they were at. They were farmers,
okay.
And they were farming, so we set up the college. And then they were able to send their kids to the school there. We set up the school for primary schools and secondary schools for education, boys and girls. And there were a certain amount of nuns, Spanish nuns, in the area already. So they were very welcoming of any foreigners coming in, and there weren't too many, into that particular area. They were delighted to see us coming in and bringing in a bit of foreign money to set up schools and set up clinics, set up anything at all. Yeah, it was easy to do it, and they were very welcome. They were lovely people. I often compare the Brazilian, rural Brazilians, like the old Irish, rural Ireland. Very like them. Very welcoming, very Christian, very Catholic, and very mass-going when there would be mass, but see, most of these people would have only got mass once a year, or twice a year. They would have to come wait for the priest to come round to get their children baptized, or to get married, and of course there'd be no one there most of the time to bury them, or anything like that. They just bury their own.
I'm just actually
it's just
a little shocked.
So
you know.
Different. It is,
yeah.
So different than anything we know here at home. It really is. So, would you like to take a break and play a bit of nice music for
Certainly
me?
Certainly will. I have Lady in Red picked out for you,
I lovely.
Believe.
I'd love Lady in Red now. I'll tell you. Do you know why I'd like that? Because I remember years ago, I don't know, but maybe 20, 30 years ago, I remember in Brazil one day, and I was in a bus, and there was no such thing as air conditioning, and it was sweltering hot. It must have been 100 or more degrees in the bus, and the fella turned on the little radio in the bus, and there was Christa Burke singing Lady in Red. So I only, to appreciate Lady in Red, I'd have to be perspiring very heavily now.
Well, it's still an association nonetheless.
Yes, it is. Thank you.
So we'll take a break now,
okay.
And we'll be right back after
yep.
this. Lady in red is dancing
people want to be there by your side. And when you turn to me and smile, you took my breath away. I have never had such a feeling of complete and utter love as I do tonight. Lady in red is dancing with me. Nobody is. It's just you and me. It's where I wanna be.
First musical choice of my guest in Life in Focus this evening, and it was Lady in Red. And Father Sean Lawler is my guest this evening. And Father Sean, you have been to Brazil for quite a while, and you did quite a bit of work there. And maybe we might just recap on kind of your work in Brazil before we continue on to discuss it a little bit more.
Very good, thank you. Well, as I explained, I went out there in 1964 and worked there for 25 years in Brazil, as did more or less 40 other Redemptorists. Eventually, there were 40 of us there. There was only three or four at the beginning, but the numbers went up and up, and we had 40 there. And other priests, secular priests from Ireland, also joined us. So at one stage, there might have been up to 45 priests there. We started off in the jungle. I literally, really mean in the jungle. As I said, we were about 1,500 miles from the sea, both to the south and to the north. To the east of us, well, you couldn't get to the sea there. It was 1,000 miles anyway, but there were no roads. And to the west, you'd have to go into other countries like Peru and Bolivia and that to get to the sea. So we were right in the heart. I used to always say in the town where I was, if you went any further into Brazil, you were coming out again. You were. It was right in the heart of Brazil. It was a poor area. It was a rural area. It was a farming area. Small farmers, for the most part, but some mighty farmers. I didn't mention this in the first half an hour, but I remember one day on the highway, well, they called them highways, you know, but they were glorified mud paths, dirt tracks. I remember one day seeing a herd of cattle coming against me. And you know they would be coming because some of the cowboys on horses would be in front of them, maybe a mile, 2 miles in front of them, warning cars to move off, move in, keep to the side, and the cattle were coming. And I was talking to one of these cowboys. There were cowboys, really. I talked to one of the cowboys, asking how many cattle they had, and he said he thought, more or less, they had 6,000 head of cattle. 6,000 head of cattle. And what were they doing with 6,000 head of cattle? They were moving them from one farm to another, which would maybe 100 or 200 miles away. Then they'd move them to another farm 200 miles away, and eventually they'd get up to the coast and they'd sell them, and this meat went to America. Very hard to imagine it. And I heard later on that it was McDonald's. Meat for McDonald's. They were slaughtered in Belém, right on the northeast coast, the mouth of the Amazon. That's where they were slaughtered, I believe. And, well, I never saw that happening now. Thank God, I wouldn't like to see that. And they were sent to America from there to McDonald's.
Reprocessed.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's and then our work in Brazil, as I was saying, it was religious work, but it was very social work also. Building for people and building schools and educating and bringing in teachers and kind of setting up infrastructure really in wherever we were. And we're still doing it in Brazil, even though some of the places now have passed us out.
I guess, good to see as well.
Yeah, it's great to see it. Some of the towns that we are in, and we're in poorer areas now, we always move into the poorer areas of the towns. Some of these towns, like I was out there last year, and I couldn't believe the city I was in. I knew it when it was a dump. It really was a dumpy city, and now it's a magnificent city. And it's called Fortaleza, it's on the northeast coast, and it's popularly known as the Rio de Janeiro of the northeast. Now, it's full of hotels, full of restaurants, beautiful streets, lovely homes. Of course, there are slums, yeah. Somebody told me there are 200 slums in Fortaleza. I don't know if that's true or not, but 200 slums. Some of them small little slums, and some of them rather big slums. And of course, then in the slum, you have all the difficulties of drugs, poverty, and drugs, and crime, and robberies. And they come out of these slums at night, and they do whatever they have to do: steal and plunder.
Could it perhaps be kind of comparable then to make the suggestion that the slums of, say, today in that place would have been similar to what you'd have found yourself in at the start when you went out to help?
That's very correct. Some of the towns I was in were just slums anyway. They were just slums. But there wasn't that terrible crime there in those days, because there was no drug scene in the 60s in Brazil, or maybe in the 70s. But one person told me last year now when I was out there that even the smallest teeny weeny little village that has drugs for sale everywhere, which is an awful pity. And when you have drugs, you have crime, you have murders, you have shootings, you have jealousies, and you have all the rest. So you have everything in Brazil now that you have in Ireland or London or New York or Detroit, even in small towns. Yeah.
Well, but maybe just kind of, if we focus a little bit, even maybe just on your time, I think we still haven't really covered everything. At the time there, you were setting up the area to kind of be self-sufficient in itself.
Yes.
But at the same time, you were fighting hard against the poverty that was there and stuff.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Well, Brazil, you have to just imagine now, if you're out of work here in Ireland, you go to social assistance, or you go to the Vincent de Paul, or you go to someone, or the government, when you're retired like me, the government gives you £200 euros a week or something like that. In Brazil, there was no social assistance. So if the dad broke his leg and he was out of work and he wasn't bringing in his 20, 30 pounds a week, whatever it was, then the mother had nothing to feed the children. And this was very, very common. Very, very common. And for instance, just at Christmas now, it wasn't much of a help to the people, but it was. I used to go to the big farmers, and we get cattle. We get rice, and we get beans, and we get money to buy butter and cheese and whatever in the local. And we'd have at least a big hamper for all the poor in the town at Christmas. Now, that wasn't a great help, because it was only Christmas.
But it was something, I guess.
It was something, but there was no social assistance. There is social assistance at the moment.
What did they do, though, say, when obviously it wasn't Christmas and, you know, that goodwill wasn't there? What did they do to feed themselves?
What did they feed themselves on? They fed themselves on charity. People would give them a bit of rice or beans or something. They'd feed themselves on a few chickens they'd have in their own backyard. Or they might rear two little pigs or something like that. And that's what they kept going. Now, that's not enough, of course, to keep going. That's not enough.
Indefinitely, so you couldn't keep going with that.
I believe when I went to Brazil, the life expectancy there was about 45 years of age. An adult.
And that was lucky, I guess, by
the
sound of it.
Was incredible, the number of children that died from malnutrition. Incredible. I remember 1981 to 1985, there was a drought in the area where I was. Now, I was in a different area. I wasn't in Miratema. I was in a place called Parnaíba, way up on the northeast coast, which is pretty desert. But it's on the coast. The sea breezes. It's a lovely place to live. And there was a drought. And all the crops died. Nothing grew. The first year, it wasn't too bad because there was stuff in the warehouses. The second year, they were hoarding it in the warehouses and they were selling it at exorbitant prices. The third year, it was nearly all gone. The fourth year and the fifth year, there was no food. So the cant was up there that even the goats died. And goats will live where there's nothing to eat. They pull up the roots and they'll eat the roots. And I remember seeing little children every day. They would bring little children into the church for a blessing on the way to the cemetery. It was just incredible. So that was, of course, when that happens, as hunger is rampant, disease is rampant, malaria was rampant all over the place. I remember even simple things in the early days, like a snake bite. There was no doctor, there was no serum, there was nothing. I remember well, never forget, one day a woman came in and she brought in her husband on a mule, the two of them on mules, and she brought in her husband on a mule, and she had, and this is a bit shocking, she had cut his arm off because of a snake bite, and he was going to die. So she cut the arm off at the elbow herself and brought him into the hospital. And who fixed him up? Euripides. Euripides stitched him and healed him, and he lived.
Amazing.
And absolutely amazing. Kind of stories like that, where all the priests out there would have stories like that and better stories like that. Bus accidents, car accidents. I remember horrific car accidents. The biggest bus accident ever, I think, in the history of the world was in Brazil, not far from ours, where two buses crashed head on and there were 78 people killed. 78 people.
Wow, that's
a
huge loss.
I didn't see that at the time, but I remember passing the spot on the road later on, and I remember counting 78 crosses. I think it was 78 crosses on the side of the road. They do it like Ireland here. They put up a cross on the side of the road, yeah.
And yourself, were you kind of involved in any kind of accidents, or did you have any illnesses that you thought, why am I here? This is...
I did.
You know...
I had one serious illness. Very shortly after going out, I got polio. Where did I get polio? I don't know. Probably not in Brazil. Probably got it on the way out in the West Indies or somewhere like that. But I developed anyway, and it affected my right leg, and it still affected. Still affected my right leg. It traumatized the muscle, the soleus muscle at the back of the leg. But it's okay. I managed it fine.
So and once you kind of were over that, you were like, go from here.
Yeah, I was never in hospital after that, though I should have been in hospital a couple of times because I got hepatitis. We all get hepatitis. I forget which hepatitis, the mild hepatitis. Three or four of us got it, or five of us got it out there. And I think it's from water that we got it. You know,
I
don't know how. I don't know how I got it really, but I got it. And they put me into hospital for a little while, and then I got out again. And
still went quite
well. But otherwise, it's amazing. In 25 years, just take, not counting those two illnesses, I never got anything. I was never in bed for a day in 25 years, apart from those two at the beginning. So we were very lucky.
It's amazing.
Now, I'd just like to say a word about, just about Brazil today before we finish up, even though we have time yet, I believe, haven't we?
Plenty of time.
Plenty of time. This is like Brazil, you know, there's loads of time. Last year when I was there, reading the papers and listening to the radio and talking to the other men in Brazil, our men in Brazil, they told me that 50 million people, that's a lot, that's 10 times the population of this island, 50 million people have come out of dire poverty in the last 8 years. 8 years, why? Because they had a president, a fellow called Lula. Lula had reformed Brazil and brought more and more industry in and got the people working, which our government could or should be doing today, getting the people back to work. He did that, and he brought 50 million people out of poverty, and I could see it everywhere. I remember one Sunday, we didn't have anybody to cook on Saturday or Sunday, so on this one Sunday we went out to dinner, and I went into the middle-class restaurant, not a fancy place, and not a cafe shop, nice little restaurant, and I looked all around, and I saw all these people sitting all around, poor to middle-class people with their kids, young couples, and sitting there eating. And I said to the boys, I said, do you guys see what's around you here? And they all looked around and said, no. They had got so used to seeing the middle class eating in restaurants. Well, I said, when I came here 40 years ago, none of these people ever ate in a restaurant.
I wouldn't know what it was.
Their fathers never ate, their mothers never ate in a restaurant. And here we are. These are part of the 50 million who have come out of poverty, and now they're having a little meal on a Sunday, which is wonderful. And I said, watch them go out, and they'll get into a banged-up Volkswagen, or they get into a little Fiat, and they'll drive home. Their fathers or mothers never had a car. In fact, they probably never had a bicycle. And that was wonderful. I was so thrilled.
It's good to see how it's come so far.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, Brazil as a country is booming today. You've heard of the BRIC countries, B-R-I-C. Brazil, India, Russia, and China. B-R-I-C, the BRIC countries, are the four countries that are going ahead in leaps and bounds today. Brazil is one of them. Except the money is not really filtering down as it should filter down. You have the rich, 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 and you have the poor, poor, poor. And you have, well, you have a better middle class than you ever had in my days there, but it doesn't filter down quickly enough. You have these magnificent cities, but you have an awful lot of poverty in the city. You have magnificent beaches, and then you have a kind of a parallel industry there. Fellas, young fellas and girls just selling oranges and bananas and this on the beaches. So it hasn't filtered down as it should filter down. That man, Lula, has left government now, and there has been a democratic election. In fact, it was this time last year, January last year, and a lady called Dilma has come in, and she's running the country. And she's of the same philosophical, we'll say, camp as he is, or was. And, of course, they say also that when she goes out of office in 4 years' time, he'll be back in again, which is a good thing, I think, because he was wonderful, and she is wonderful, and she has vowed to take another 50 million people out of poverty. So in the end of, eight and four, 12 years or so, 100 million people will have come out of poverty, hopefully in Brazil.
Which is an astonishing figure.
It's
but
an
then
astonishing.
Do you think that there is still need for the Redemptorist and other orders to be still in Brazil helping out? Or do you think that the government themselves are now handling it?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. I think it's every country, like our own country here, like we're doing fine. But we do need our churches and we do need our prayer life and our sacramental life and all. So you do need the priests and that for that. But, I mean, there's no doubt about it that the government have taken it into their own hands nowadays. And things we introduced, like electricity in our area, people had never seen it, and we introduced, and then they went ahead and bound leaps and bounds and got their own. Farming, they had never known how to farm, really. So things like that, all we did was give them a jump start and then push them, and off they go themselves. So, yeah, I believe that the Redemptorists have a place in Brazil for years and years to come, definitely. And would you believe it now, this might shock you, there are still places in Brazil are as primitive today as they were when I went.
That they haven't been touched.
They haven't been really touched at all by the wealth of Brazil. And what has happened very often is that the mega farmers, like the guy who owns the 6,000 head of cattle, mm-hmm. the mega farmer is buying more and more land, and he's expelling the small little farmer from his land.
So he's getting richer, but the rest are still
getting
poorer.
And the little farmer that was working near us has now fled into the city, and his children have fled into the city with nothing. At least they had a pig and a cow
they had sustenance before, but now they've
now they've gone into the city and they're on the peripheries of cities in huge, some of them.
So there is still a lot of work to be
doing.
There
is, huge amount of work. There is.
Perhaps we'll take another little break we'll come right back and we'll see, you know, what you're up to these days. And
okay, that'd be fine. That'd be lovely, yeah.
Desire is always to be here, oh my.
Samal of Kintyre there, another choice of our guest for Life in Focus this evening. Father Sean Lawler is with us and speaking about his time in Brazil, and that song has a kind of connection for you.
Yes, I asked you to play that song for me because I suppose it must be 30, 40 years ago. A man lived with me called Brother Pascal Doherty. He was a Redemptorist from Derry. And his family sent him out a little present one day. And when he opened it, there was this record, small record. And the only way we could play it was on an old gramophone, which we didn't have. But we got a loan of a gramophone from somebody there, I forget whom. And we played this record, The Mull of Kintyre. And seeing it was the only bit of music we had in the house, we played it over and over and over and over again until I think we wore it. The needle went right down through it, I think. So I love that old song. So anyway, that's why I picked that one.
Connected with good times.
Sentimental reasons.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, before we did take the break, we were talking about Brazil today. And here, even in Ireland, we have a lot of Brazilian communities.
Yes,
so
indeed.
Have you focused your work now that you're here with those? Or
That's right. For the last 6 or 7 years, I have done practically no other work except work with the Brazilian community here in Ireland. I work in with the Brazilians in Loughrea, Athenry, Gort, of course, Ennis, Limerick, Charleville, Fermoy, and there might be Middleton, and that's about it, those towns. I concentrate in that. There's another fellow on the East Coast, and he concentrates in the Dublin area and that. Why, you might ask me, why do I kind of give my life to them now at the moment? Well, about 15 years ago, a big meat factory closed in Brazil. And one of the directors of that meat factory was an Irishman. I think his name was O'Callaghan, and I think his name was from Cork. He was on the TV, he was on TV recently, actually. And because this factory out there closed, an awful lot of men, boners, as they're called, were out of work. And when he came home to Ireland, he got involved in another meat factory, which I believe was in Gort. It was Duffy's Meat Factory. And then he said he'd bring over. So he brought over a dozen workers, got them legalized, or documented as they say, they were all documented, a dozen men. And that dozen men grew eventually to be about 25,000 in 10 or 12 or 14 years. Yes, their girlfriends came over, their wives came over, their buddies came over, and I would be inclined to say most of them came over illegally. They came over as tourists, they came in as a tourist, they got a month here in Ireland, and they never went home.
They made it home.
Now, some of them were caught and some of them were sent home, and the Gardaí could catch any of them that they wanted any day, but they don't bother. But once they behave themselves and are good living citizens, they stay here. Now, if they start drinking and start driving, or if they drive without insurance, or if they drive without the license, they're caught, they're gone. And I've had lots of incidents of that. I could tell you one or two funny incidents, really, about it, or bad incidents.
Go for it.
I will tell you one in a minute. But he brought those over anyway, and the crowd grew. And then, of course, there were no more jobs in the meat factories, so they had to start working with farmers. So they looked after horses, and they looked after cattle, and they looked after... there was a fellow here in Charleville, and he was looking after horses, actually. And he was an evangelical fellow, and he used to read his Bible, and he was looking after horses at night. Now, why you have to do that at night, I don't know. But he was looking after horses for a fellow at night. And I said to him, well, what do you do at night? He says, I read the Bible. And I said, really, you read the Bible? Yeah, he said. And do you look after horses? I do, he says. And the horses know their Bible. That's what he said to me. Anyway.
Excellent.
So the men were doing building walls and painting, doing all that, any job they could take. You know, I remember one fellow came to me and he told me that he had a good job as a painter. I said, but you can't paint. I can't now, he said. Well, I said, explain it. How did they take you on as a painter? Well, he said, they asked me to paint the house. Did I know how to paint? I said, yeah. And I said, I was too busy. I couldn't take the job for 2 days. So I went off and I learned from a buddy of mine how to paint. And he
well,
got the
fair
job
play to him. I mean, he was obviously trying. He's hard
now,
out there.
It's very hard, of course, with the recession for the last 4 years to get a job in Ireland. Even for ourselves to get a job, it's very hard. So the men are really down on their heel at the moment, a lot of them. What did the women do? Well, the women clean houses. Fascina, as they call it. Fascina is a house cleaner. So the women are excellent, and they do a really good job on that. And they earn good money because they charge about 10 euros an hour, which is fine for them, and they do 6 or 7 euros. Yeah, they're picking up 60 euros a day, which is very often more than the husband is picking up out when he's looking after the horses or cattle or something like that, or building walls. They're good at the building walls with that nice rock they face
out.
Yeah, exactly. So the women have, but even with the recession now, the women are not picking up that much money because the housewives are not, you know, haven't got 60 euros to throw around and are offering them 6 and 7 euros an hour, which is not fair. They can't afford to do that, you know, especially if they have to pay somebody, another Brazilian girl, to look after the kids at home. So it's not worth it. However, that's the, as I said, it grew from 12 men at the start to about 25,000. We think only God knows how many Brazilians were in Ireland at any particular stage, and only God knows today how many Brazilians are in Ireland. I know that my masses in all these towns that I just mentioned, my mass frequency has, no, not the frequency, but the numbers assisting at the mass have gone down gravely, seriously, over the last two
so
or three years.
So do you think they're moving back?
They're moving back to Brazil, yes, moving back to Brazil. And there's no question of them leaving the country. You see, there's no immigration there. They just go, and they go back. But if they try to come back into Ireland again, then they're caught because they don't have any visa on their thing. I remember when you asked me there a minute ago about, I remember being called down to the jail in Limerick. I'm often in the jail in Limerick because we don't have any proper system in the Shannon Airport when a person is caught coming into the country and their immigration is doubtful about him or her. We have no place to put them, holding stations. So what do? They put them into jail in Limerick for a day or two or 3 days until they sort out
their documents. Until they figure it out.
So then I'm called down and I translate for them and blah, blah, blah. But one day I was called down and there was this nice man, Brazilian man, and I said, "And what's wrong? Why are you here?" "I don't know," he said, "I don't know. I was just picked up at Shannon Airport, and all I know is I'm here, and they took my wife away too." I said, "Your wife?" "Yes," he said, "they took my wife." "And where's your wife?" "I don't know," he said. And I said, "Would she be here?" So I asked them in the jail. "Yeah," they said, "his wife is up in the ladies." So I talked to him. I said, what are you coming to Ireland for?" He said, "We're on our honeymoon this week, and we were in Portugal, and somebody told us that Ireland is a lovely country. Go up to as far as Ireland, and you'll have a great time for 2 or 3 days and come back here again." And we did. And we were picked up at Shannon Airport, and they took my wife in one car, and they took me in another car.
And this is where they've ended up.
I said, "Let's get your wife." I said, "Are you really married?" "We are." I said, "Have you any documentation to prove it?" "No," he said. "Well," I said, "maybe I could ring Brazil, or I could ring your parish priest, or I could ring your bishop, and we can just..." So we talked about that for a while, but that was getting very complicated. And I remembered, fortunately, that Brazilian boys put their wife's name on the inside of their wedding band, and the Brazilian wife puts her husband's name on the inside of her wedding. I said, "Is that your wedding band?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Is your wife's name on it?" "Yes." I said, "Is the date of your wedding on it?" "Yes." "Great," I said, "we have them." So they went upstairs and they got his wife and brought him down. And I saw the governor of the jail, a lovely man called O'Riordan at the time. And I said, "Look, this situation is this." And he called immigration. He said, "These people shouldn't be in here at all. Take them back." So immigration brought him out to the airport. What did they do with him? Send him straight back to Brazil. They didn't even allow giving them a month in Ireland or a week in Ireland.
A week or a few days like they only wanted.
I know. It was, we weren't really ready for this influx of foreigners at all. We didn't know how to handle them. And I think they know how to handle them now a little bit better, but still. Of course, I have pity on immigration too, because immigration are being abused. They are being abused, you see, by people lying and lying and lying.
Exactly. They don't know who to trust or not.
Not only from Brazil, but from all over.
Over, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe we could just maybe focus a little bit then on, say, your day-to-day duties and kind of the things that you get up to then.
Yeah. Okay. Every weekend is sacred because I have masses and baptisms, or not marriages now. They don't seem to get married. They're good at checking up, but they're not so good at married, I think. They probably learned that in Ireland over the years, I say.
Oh, gee.
Anyway, they're not getting married, but they are having their kids, and they are baptizing their kids, and they are coming to Mass, a lot of them. So that's what I do on the weekends.
And would you travel up and down?
Yeah, I go to all
parishes,
these places. I do two places every Sunday. I would do like, for instance, Charleville and Fermoy on last weekend to us, actually. I did Charleville and Fermoy. And I have a good group in Charleville, and they're very good to come to the church, and they're very good to sing, and they play the guitar, and there's some musicians, a man called Ivan Ildo, he plays the keyboard, and there's two guys on guitar, and the people come to that mass because they love the bit of music. They really do. I think they're more interested in the music now than in my homily or anything that I do there, you know. They would be. But that's on the third Saturday here, the fourth, and the third Sunday is down in Fermoy, where there's a lovely group too. Not very musical, mind you. There isn't a note, and I don't think they have a note between them. But they're good to come to church, and they're very pleasant. And then we have usually have a bit of meal after with them. So that's it. We also have Sister Martina is in the Mercy Convent here. She's Miss Brazil herself, because she helps me so much with the Brazilian Society.
And I'll have to let her know that she's Miss Brazil.
Oh, tell her, let her know she's Miss Brazil. She'd kill me for saying that, of course. But anyway, she does. She gets the tea and the coffee and the biscuits, and they bring their own food, and sometimes we have dinner in that little avenue that goes up beside the convent, and there's a little, I suppose it used to be in a hospital, I think, a tiny hospital. It's some kind of a clinic now, or belong to the health board. We have a fine big hall in there, and that's where we have our mass. And Martina sets up the business for us there on. So that's what we do on the weekends.
May I ask just before you continue, is that open to anyone, or is it just the Brazilian community?
Oh, it's open to anyone. We'd love.
I think I want to go.
Yeah, we'd love anyone to come in there, especially here in Charleville, because the music is good.
Unfortunately, I'm not good at music myself now.
No, you don't have to be good at music. Just
I'd be more inclined to the Fermoy.
No, we love anyone to come into there and participate, and some do, very few. And then when we have a baptism on the weekend here, we do it in the church. And Father Sean Cotter is immensely helpful to us. He's very good. He facilitates everything and gives us the church, and we do the baptisms up there. I don't like doing the baptisms in a small little hall. It's nicer to have in the full church and with all the people come. And usually they turn up for the baptism, so it's nice. Now, that's my work on a Saturday and on a Sunday. You might say then, what would I do on a Monday morning? Well, very often nothing. I wouldn't have anything. I'd stay in my own church in Limerick and work in Mount St. Alphonsus, which is a very busy church. So any of my free time, I give it to Mount St. Alphonsus. But when I have something like a car accident, not me, but when the Brazilians have a car accident, are caught without a license or whatever it might be, without insurance, then they're in trouble. Then I have to get them a solicitor, and then I do the translation work for them and write out the papers for them. And I accompany that process until he or she is through the other end, whether they're fined or they're expelled from the country, deported or something. I stay with that process. Accidents are more serious. There have been some bad accidents, and there have been one horrific accident, and I'm accompanying it now through the courts for the last three or four years, and we're talking about 600,000, 700,000 euros worth of compensation, which is huge.
Yeah.
The poor man is very seriously, grievously hurt back in Brazil, and he'll never be right again, never be really right again. And his son came over here and lived here with him for 6 months after the accident, and they're back in Brazil now at a very good solicitor, excellent solicitor, and he's following along nice and slowly, but these things grind along very slowly, you know.
So you kind of just offer support then
to
people that may find themselves in trouble in
I'm the first to call. I'm the first port to call. And if I can do it, I can do it. And usually can, because it's usually only a matter of getting a solicitor and translating for them and being by their side and visiting them
Just being there for them.
That's all. So that would be my work on a Tuesday or a Wednesday or a Thursday. And the rest of the time then I would visit them. I'd visit them in their homes and see how they're getting on. Now, when I went to Brazil first, this is just going back a little bit. When I went to Brazil first, I would think about 90-something percent. We used to say 96%. I don't know where we got that statistic. But 96% of Brazilians were Catholic. I would think now that only about 60%, give or take, 60% are Catholic. They're still Catholic at heart, but they have moved into the evangelical churches. So they're more into the Alleluia and the dancing at Masses and following a local leader. And I can understand that in a way, because we're foreigners. No matter how long we're in Brazil, even 50 years in Brazil, we're still foreigners. And when they get one of their own, speaking their own language and dancing their own dances, and who's also married, and they know his wife and they know his kids, they move into his little church. Now, he would have little or no education at all. He certainly would have no theology. He'd have no philosophy. But he has their way of living, you see. So they join his churches. And it's happening here. In all the towns I work with, people wouldn't know this now, but there are at least two evangelical churches in every town. And my people, I call them my people, drift into their churches. But when I want anything, a solicitor or a lawyer or something, they drift back to me again. Or where there's an accident, they're back to me again.
Back
or
to
a maternity
you.
Case, they're back to me again. Or any kind of a case, they're back to me again. So they don't fix themselves like, can
they,
you imagine
they don't
your,
fully leave and
no,
they
don't fully
stay.
Leave or they don't fully join. Can you imagine your granny, like 50 years ago, becoming a Protestant?
Not a
no, or a Catholic. A Protestant wouldn't become a Catholic. You're born into a church, you die in the church. They're born in the church, and when they're 6 years of age, they change, and 8 years of age, they change over and back and over and back. It's hard. It's really hard for us to understand it, but that's their culture, and that's the way they are, and I suppose it's more a reflection on us not being able to understand it than they swapping from church to church. So that's... What am I talking about? Yes, I'm talking about what do I do from day to day.
That's basically it,
that's
I guess.
Basically it, you know, basically it.
And we actually have run out of time, so thank you. We have indeed.
Oh.
Thank you very much for joining me this evening. It was.
Thank you. And it was lovely to talk to the people. And I hope they, you know, get some bit of, find something interesting for themselves.
Yeah, so
you know?
We will leave it there. Any final words that you'd like to say?
Yes, I'd like you to pick a bit of music now and play it for me.
Unfortunately, and probably luckily, we don't have time.
We don't have time. Well, okay.
Thank you very much for
thank
coming.
Thank you indeed, and thanks very much for talking to me today. Thank you. God bless. Thank you.
We'll be back next week with Life in Focus. So until then, goodbye.
Tune in every Saturday evening from 6 to 7pm for a Life in Focus, where we will be chatting with a local personality about their life, work, leisure and philosophy. BCRFM, putting a life in focus every Saturday from 6 to 7.